Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, this is Billie Jean King.
This is Marion Bartoli.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carrillo.
This is Pam Shriver.
This is Yannick Noah.
This is Mary Dempsey from Chicago. You're listening to The Tennis Podcast.
Well, hello and welcome to the Tennis Podcast, introduced beautifully there by Mary Dempsey. Very fitting that we should have a Mary introduce the show today, because our good friend and all-around wonderful human being, Mary Carrillo, is going to be a big part of today's show, because today is our 2023 review show with contributions from some very esteemed and interesting colleagues, including Mary Carrillo. We also have Pam Shriver, Chris Clary, Hannah Wilkes, Matt Futterman, and a very, very special guest cameo, which I will tease throughout the show. You might be able to guess who it is. It's going to be a great show, guys. We've listened to these voice notes. All of these contributors. They are people that are, in one way or another, a big part of the Tennis Podcast family. They all contribute to our Grand Slam review shows that we've been doing for a couple of years now for friends of the Tennis Podcast, where we get the views of other people about how they reflect on the Grand Slam that we've just seen. And we use their takes as a jumping off point for our own. And they always take us in directions that we don't expect to go, and they are unfailingly brilliant, and these are no different, David.
Yeah, it's interesting, you know, when we first started that concept of show, that format, I think it was at the Australian Open in 2022 when we'd only just launched Friends of the Tennis Podcast, and I wasn't there, and I was saying to you, after you just witnessed and reported on Rafael Nadal's extraordinary victory at about 3 a.m. and you're high on everything but also exhausted, and I said, do you know what you should do? You should now go and doorstep everybody you can find to get extra reaction for our review show. And you looked at me with a mixture of how do I put this? You didn't want to say you were unenthusiastic, but you also were absolutely wiped out. And I said, or I could send them a voice note, or I could send them a message and ask for a voice note. And you said, yeah, let's do that. Yeah. And who'd have thought that would have led to such an amazing format of show for the future? Because, I mean, it really does add something, because we can get them from people wherever they are in the world. I feel as though when you're talking into a phone and giving a voice note, and I'm somebody who loves to give a voice note, you really throw yourself into it. And that has been the evidence that we've had from all the people that have taken part the last couple of years. And I'm telling you, this one is no different.
Yeah, and Matt, it also helps with giving us a new perspective, right? Because with all these review shows, we're talking about stuff that we've already talked about. And obviously, talking tennis to death is our trade, and we love to do it. But you don't necessarily want to just hear us remind you of things we've said earlier on in the year, about things we've talked about earlier on in the year. But this, it puts new perspectives on on old events in weird and wonderful ways. And that's a cool thing, I think, for us and hopefully for the listeners as well.
Yeah, totally. I always get a slightly different angle from these contributors to something that I've already thought of, which is great. And yeah, I seem to remember the original plan for post-Australian Open 2022 was that we would go to Rafael Nadal's Champions press conference. But I believe the notification about when he was going to be doing that came through while we were recording our final show, and it was about 6 o'clock in the morning at this time in Melbourne, and he was going to be there in about 4 hours or something. It was going to be like some sort of Champions press conference from his bed was sort of what I was anticipating, and there was just absolutely no way that we were going to make that. So we pivoted and we got this joyous voice note experience, which has become such a staple for us now. And it's good to be able to give our main feed a little taste of what the friends are getting multiple times a year.
Yeah, consider this a little tease. If you're on the fence about becoming a friend of the Tennis Podcast, these are the shows that we do, among other shows exclusively for friends. Tennis Relived, of course, is a big part of that offering, and our Q&A shows as well. But we do these shows after every slam. We try and record them all together. We stay on a day or two. Certainly we're going to be doing that in Australia, giving us time to gather these voice notes and have a bit of reflection on the Grand Slam that's just gone. So if you like what you hear today and you're thinking of becoming a friend, the link to do that is in our show notes. Obviously, in last week's show, I was promoting all of the mascot slots that have now become available, the various guest editorships, etc., etc. A lot of those have been snapped up, folks. Our mascot slots have flown off the shelves. Was very worried when only two presenter mascot slots were gone, but you can all breathe a sigh of relief. All three have gone. David, Matt and myself have all been snapped up. So no awkward conversations to ensue. There are still some things that you can get your hands on if you'd like to. There are guest editorships. There are executive producer slots. There are private podcasts. You can, of course, get yourself an intro like Mary did today, or a shout out. And you can just become a friend of the Tennis Podcast and get access to everything that we do year round. And you'd be supporting us year round in what we do. So thank you if you've recently signed up to become a friend. Thank you if you're a long-standing friend. It is great to have you. And without further ado, let's look back on the year that was 2023. And we have got, we've got a bit of structure for the show. We asked each of our contributors to give us an answer in five categories reflecting on the year and a little bit of looking ahead to 2024 as well. They are moment of the year, surprise of the year, disappointment of the year, biggest fear from 2023 or looking ahead to 2024, and your big tennis wish. Let's start, shall we, by hearing what people's moment of 2023 has been, and we got a lot of different perspectives here, folks. So let's start by hearing from the one and only Pam Shriver.
Well, the moment I will remember most personally in 2023 was for the first time ever venturing out as a coach solo without a co-coach, was to Monterey with Donna Vekic. And you know, thanks to her resilience, amazing play, Donna ended up the champion of Monterey. So to have the experience after 45 years in tennis, to be like the coach in the player box when your player finishes first was really amazing.
That's a really nice way to start, isn't it? Because if you'll allow us a moment of sort of personal indulgence, sort of enjoying our friend Pam as a coach has been one of, perhaps not the moment, but one of the sort of cumulative moments of 2023 for us, hasn't it? And it's also given us a real window onto the life of a coach and coaching dynamics and, you know, the other side of that door.
Yeah, I think so many times this year I've been the Leonardo DiCaprio gif pointing at the screen, like when Pam comes on in the coaching box. It's like, oh, it's Pam coaching. It's great. And I think what I found really special was that Pam, who has been involved in tennis all her life, really, is still getting new experiences out of the sport. I think that's really special that you can still be involved in the sport and still gaining something new from it. And hearing Pam talk about the way she felt like she was almost doing some of the things now with Donna that maybe she wished she'd done in her own career, or just imparting a bit of the wisdom that she has onto Donna, I just felt was really, really special. And yeah, I think especially the first half of the season, that was a really big part of it for us, sort of learning through Pam about what modern day coaching is like.
2023 was also the year that I saw Pam coaching Matt briefly, or actually perhaps even not even really coaching Matt, because I mean she was just praising Matt, just heaping praise upon Matt's half follies. What a moment. What a moment. So that's Pam. Let's hear now from Hannah Wilkes, who of course has become a big part of the Tennis Podcast team over the years, and she's a big part of our plans for 2024 and onwards, and she always has an interesting perspective on things. Here's hers on her moment of 2023.
So I decided that I was just going to go for the first answer that came to mind when I thought of the moment I would remember from 2023, and in a radical departure from form, I'm going to be a bit of a downer and say that the moment I think I'll remember from this year is honestly, a moment I wish I could forget, which is the moment in the press conference room at Wimbledon when we all got to see just Andy Murray's heart literally break in real time when he got told that the that the return he hit, you know, at 4-all in the fourth set against Tsitsipas, which was called out, was actually in. And just the look on his face. I just think that defeat and the way that match played out was one of the most genuinely crushing things that's happened in Andy Murray's career. And just the look on his face at that moment kind of encapsulated all of the reasons why. Like, it's not about Tsitsipas, who played such a brilliant match. Like, probably his best match of the year. Maybe, I don't really remember. I don't really remember what else he did this year, which might say a lot, but you know, just I really thought, and a lot of us thought, that this was Andy Murray's Wimbledon swan song moment, you know, the kind of the one last run, which he's basically stayed in the sport for and sacrificed all that time with his family for, and you know, he's jeopardizing all his remaining non-metallic joints for. You know, like the form that he came in with and the form that Tsitsipas came in with. And I just thought it was going to be Murray's moment for a moment. And when he got told in that press conference that return that he didn't challenge had in fact been in, you know, he kind of did that sort of like disbelieving little like ask for confirmation, like he couldn't believe what he was hearing. And then he just looked down. And in that moment, you know, I think we saw that he had thought that this was his moment too. It's just was just raw kind of devastation, you know, like just the real fact of that defeat and how bad it felt to a man who's kind of staring down the barrel of the end of his tennis career, you know, his tennis mortality, the end of this endeavor that's been everything to him. Yeah, it was crushing. And I kind of wish I hadn't started talking about it, but I did.
I'm kind of glad Hannah did start talking about that, because I'd forgotten about that moment in the press conference, that flicker on Andy Murray's face when that dawned on him, and when it dawned on the room that he didn't know. It really was, in the truest sense, sort of moment of the year, sort of moment in time. It really was so weighty. And the way the second half of the season has panned out for Andy Murray, looking back on that moment and that match now, and I agree with Hannah, that was some of the best tennis I've ever seen since a past play. That was the best match I saw him play this year. He was fantastic. But the way the second half of the season has panned out from an Andy Murray perspective, and the more I think that we're going to look back on that Wimbledon as the moment that wasn't. That was what we were all waiting for Murray. That was the chance. And look, whether that call was what snuffed it out, look, we don't know. But I now question whether we're ever going to get that moment that he's been making the sacrifices for. And I think that might have been the chance.
I think he's still got another shot at it, but this is the last one. I don't think he'll be playing beyond this year. And but he would need to get himself into that sort of form again, because he was actually in really good form. Mm. He was playing really well in that match. Should have won it. And yes, Tsitsipas did play well, but yes, you only get so many chances at this age when you're actually playing well and the body's holding up. So yeah, it was a shuddering moment in the press conference, I agree.
Mm, yeah. Let's hear from Chris Clary, now longtime friend of the show, author of The Master, of course, the book about Roger Federer, formerly of the New York Times, of course, now big in Substack, which is just a subset of the internet that I haven't engaged with nearly as much as I should have done. But it's where the cool kids are hanging out now that Elon Musk is doing his best to kill Twitter. Let's hear from Chris on his moment of 2023.
Not a hard one. Men's Wimbledon final. Alcaraz and Djokovic. Their match in Cincinnati might have been a better match in some ways just because of the crazy twists and turns, but nothing as big as Wimbledon. Nothing as prime time as that. Couldn't take your eyes off it. Alcaraz basically stopped a Grand Slam and barely, 6-4 in the fifth. And if he hadn't won that second set tiebreaker, I don't think he would have won the match. So it definitely, it was on a knife's edge. Don't think it was quite the quality of the greatest of the great 2008 Wimbledon final with Federer and Nadal, of course, and 1980 Borg and McEnroe. But it was awfully good, and just the rising champion against the great champion. It's a terrific plot line, storyline, and there was so much anticipation about that match, and it delivered, which is always the best thing, isn't it? And I personally love intergenerational duels like that, and Alcaraz's tennis is so incandescent and he wasn't able to sustain it for the rest of the season for a variety of reasons. It did seem like that could have been a changing of the guard, and it wasn't, as Novak proved the rest of the year. But it was still a match to savor, and it took a supreme effort and so much strength and variety and skill to knock Djokovic off his perch there. And I don't know that it was quite as momentous as it appeared at the time. I mean, to stop Novak from getting the 8th Wimbledon title, matching Federer, and probably stop the slam, as things turns out, though you never know how people are going to handle that pressure if they come into New York with all three, as we've seen before with Serena and Novak in the past. But good chance it did, but it was a heck of a thing, and honestly, even without all the stakes that were in play there, just terrific. It had electricity all its own, and and they really match up in a special way. And bring on more of that in 2024, please.
Hear, hear, Chris. And it's a reminder, isn't it, that this time 12 months ago, we thought maybe that rivalry was jinxed. Will we ever see it again? Will they constantly be dancing around one another in the tennis world? Were we just given one cruel taste of that matchup, that rivalry in Madrid last year, only to have it wrenched away from us forevermore? And we shouldn't take for granted, should we, what we're treated to when they meet, because it's not going to last that long. It is going to be a snapshot, a moment in time. And it's hard to argue with that men's Wimbledon final being one of the moments of 2023. Awfully good is the most excellently understated assessment of that tennis match from Chris there. Love it.
And I think even going into that match, we were wondering whether that rivalry was jinxed, because we'd just had the French Open end as it did between them with Alcaraz cramping. And that was such a big part of that match for me going into it. How would Alcaraz cope with the aura of Novak Djokovic on centre court? And it was a bad start from him. He lost that first set so one-sidedly. You know, it didn't feel like it was going to turn into the classic that it did, but the way Alcaraz won all of the big moments in that match, the second set tiebreak, the 27-minute game, the key break at the start of the fifth, we just hadn't seen someone do that to Novak Djokovic in a Grand Slam final who is, you know, so much younger than him. It was extraordinary. And this whole sort of changing of the guard thing, I do find a bit hard to sort of work out, because I mean, it quite literally was like it was the thing that we'd been waiting to happen. Like if the young guy beating Novak Djokovic in the Wimbledon final isn't the changing of the guard, then sort of what is? Like, what more are we asking for from these young players? But of course, Novak Djokovic's response has just sort of put a lid on that conversation for now and said, okay, he may have stopped me there, but I am still here. It's not been the permanent changing of the guard that we maybe thought it might be. But in that moment, it very much was one, I would say, in a way that we hadn't experienced before.
Yeah, and I know we joke about David's high on life and sort of a beer and a half prediction of Carlos Alcaraz winning the next 3 years worth of slams after that final. I know we joke about that, and you know, David was. I'll give you the benefit of the doubt here, David. You're over-egging it a bit, but the point you were making was, he's 20 years old. He's just dethroned Novak Djokovic in the most difficult way possible. He's only going to get better. Novak Djokovic is only going to get older. Logically, how can you see him losing any slams? How can you see him losing these things if he stays fit? And the fact that Novak Djokovic has just slammed the door on him since then, temporarily, I think, because age will catch up to Djokovic eventually. It might be when he's in his 60s, but it has to happen eventually. But the fact that Djokovic has turned that seemingly unstoppable tide is pretty extraordinary, I think.
I think in hindsight now, that might be my moment of the year. That Cincinnati final, when Djokovic has already lost a match of great importance to him, arguably the biggest match of the year in many ways, and he's lost it. And then he's regrouped, he's come back and played him again, and he's about to lose again, because Alcaraz was getting the better of that in Cincinnati at one point. Should have won, arguably. And Djokovic found a way to win it. And then the year was different after that. And I think that's extraordinary. I agree with you. I mean, it's just, I didn't see that coming. And maybe that's just naive of me, given who Djokovic is, but how he didn't have self-doubt to the to the point where, and I think he did have self-doubt in that final, in that Cincinnati final. I think he was struggling physically. The heat was hurting. Alcaraz was all over him. And yet he still found a way. And that actually elevated him, in my estimation, even further. So did Sinner's response later in the year. That's what I love about this sport. It's just full of one-upmanship. It's response and counter-response. You know, it's just brilliant.
Just while we're on Novak Djokovic, I think it's important to say that, because it feels so obvious now, but he took the lead in the men's Grand Slam race this year. You know, he wasn't leading it at the start of the year, and now it feels like he's so far off in the distance. But I think, you know, I think the fact that no one has sort of said Novak Djokovic getting to 23 at Roland Garros as their moment of the year was just perhaps indicative of the fact that it didn't quite feel like it reflected the enormity of the achievement, that match. Like when Federer got the record, it was that amazing match at Wimbledon. When Nadal got the record, it was that amazing match in Melbourne against Medvedev. And for Djokovic, it was a great first set against Rude, but then it was kind of a procession to victory, wasn't it, after that? It didn't quite feel fitting, but that was a huge moment. And I do remember Novak Djokovic, this look of fulfillment and contentment coming across him as he stood there and the national anthem was playing, and it was like he'd got to the point that he'd been chasing for so many years. And I think the fact that he achieved that and then still had all these remarkable moments against Carlos Alcaraz in the second half of the year just goes to show what a sort of champion he is, and how he's able to just find this extra motivation all the time. I mean, it has been one of his most extraordinary seasons, and that is saying a lot.
Yeah, to think that I questioned where his motivation might go after that Wimbledon final because of the calendar slam bubble having been burst. Yeah, it just feels so ridiculous now. But I do think Carlos Alcaraz is a massive contributor to that renewed motivation. And, you know, had he beaten somebody else in that Cincinnati final, I don't think he would have gone into the US Open with his teeth as sharp as they were. He sharpened his teeth on Carlos Alcaraz that day. And, yeah, I feel like... I know they played other matches in the season, but I do feel like that Wimbledon final and the Cincinnati final, those two matches are a diptych, I think. They're companion pieces to one another. That's how I sort of will look back on their rivalry this year. I'll remember Matt coming back from getting snacks at the French Open because we thought we were going to be settled in for another two long sets, only to find Carlos Alcaraz in a crumpled heap on the floor. You know, I'll remember their match that I watched at the Palla Alpitour in Turin, and Djokovic just looking utterly supreme. I'll remember all of their matches, but it's those two that stand out and stand together. I think they're a work of art. Our last two contributors in this category have the same moment of the year. So let's hear now from Mary Carrillo and The Athletic's Matt Futterman.
The moment I'll most remember from the season is Coco Gauff coming good at the U.S. Open. Coco had been struggling so much with her forehand at the start of 2022. And I remember sitting with you three at the pre-French Open Coco press conference. I had watched Coco practice the day before, and her forehand was all over the place. I mean, to the point where she was apologizing to her hitting partner for missing so much and missing so badly. At that press conference, I asked Coco if she herself knew what was wrong with her forehand and how much she would be working on it, like in a one-hour practice session. I just wanted to know how stressed out it was making her, basically, because she looked stressed when I was watching her. Anyway, she pretty much dodged both questions, didn't she? Saying she really leaves it up to her coach to design the practice sessions. But then she changed coaches in the summer, and they decided not to focus so much on that shot, at least not during the season, and just established confidence in every other part of her game. And by the time she was in the championship match in New York, She was repeatedly asking her coaches to just keep quiet and let her work. God, I love that. I felt like she'd really grown and really shown what she could do. And she wears her fame lightly, which I really admire. Hopefully it stays that way, and hopefully she'll be shoring up her forehand in the off season. Because if she can make it anything like her backhand, she's going to win more majors.
Hi there. So the moment I'm going to remember most from 2023, probably not going to surprise a lot of people, is just those minutes after Coco Gauff won the U.S. Open in September. And it was just this strange sort of like cacophony of things, where it was this the noise of the crowd and my phone blowing up with pictures and messages from my daughters, who are these huge Coco fans, and then looking up and looking over and seeing Coco sort of collapsing in a puddle of tears with her parents. And I'm sort of trying to do my work and filing this story on deadline. And I realized there's just tears streaming down my face, which is not really the image you want to have in the press seats when you're covering the U.S. Open final for the New York Times. But nevertheless, that was it. And it was just sort of all of these things sort of happening in this moment of real sort of pure joy that seemed to evoke memories of Serena when she won for the first time, and even a year before when Alcaraz won for the first time, and maybe even the year before that when Raducanu won her, let's be optimistic and say, first title as well, and a very, very emotional thing. And there's just something about that U.S. Open final that comes, you know, at the end of a long season when everybody is exhausted, writers and players alike, though players certainly more so and for other reasons than writers, that I think can get you at a really weak moment, or really a strong moment if we want to look at it as the glass is half full.
Wow. I wasn't expecting that. I don't know about you, Catherine. I mean, we've known Matt for some time, but I wasn't expecting it to have got to him quite like that. And it's beautiful. It's a beautiful thought, the way his daughters have responded to Coco's win. But I get that. You know, when I think about it, there was just a joy in that stadium that night, because I think everybody loves Coco Gauff, and everybody knows it's only a few years, but everybody knows the struggle she's gone through trying to maximize this game and make the best of it and find a way to win with it. And God, that was fantastic.
Yeah, how can we all have been on such a journey with Coco Gauff and her still be so young? It's pretty ridiculous, really. Very reassuring for me to hear that other extremely professional people also cry in the press seats occasionally. That is very reassuring for me. It was a moment, wasn't it? Coco Gauff flat on her back in that luminous fluorescent kit on the Arthur Ashe Stadium, shouting out the haters in her speech. That wasn't on my bingo card for 2023, and doing it all without fixing the forehand. You know, I'm fascinated now about how that forehand comes out in 2024. Does she say, look, I won a Grand Slam with this forehand, with sort of mental jiggery pokery to disguise my weakness rather than correct it, in the words of one of Carrillo's laws. But that doesn't mean it isn't still a relative weakness. If she's going to address that weakness, that also means kind of giving way a bit mentally, adjusting the mindset that won her the US Open, which is, let's pretend it's not the problem that I've been building it up to be in my mind. Is she going to come out in Australia with a brand new forehand, or is she? What's that face for, David?
I don't think it's possible. I just don't.
You don't think you think it's going to be an identical shot?
I think there might be some tweaks, but I mean, I think the disguising was the genius, and the way they made it work to loop it. And yeah, she can crack it sometimes, but to try to just avoid it getting picked on. And I'm afraid, I think if she were to really believe that she's fixed it and then not have that approach to her game because she thinks it's fixed, I think she's going to get a nasty surprise. I just don't think it's possible.
She, yeah, okay. Matt?
I'm not expecting it to be fixed, as David said. I think there was an incredible life lesson in there, sort of, from Coco Gauff this summer, the way that, you know, we've probably all had that thing that we've been fixated on, and it can sort of feel like it's stagnating the rest of your life, and you sort of can't really allow the other parts of yourself to sort of blossom. And I think she sort of was able to do that this summer by sort of blocking out the forehand issues and realizing, well, I'm still the best athlete out here, and I've still got one of the best backhands, and I can still win tennis matches. And I think it was an amazing solution for that run and for that time period. But I think her forehand as it is at the moment, to me, puts a limit on how high her actual ceiling can be. And, you know, if we're talking about Coco Gauff as potentially winning, you know, multiple slams, I can't really see that with her forehand how it is at the moment, because I think she will... Look, I really don't want to take anything away. She was awesome at that US Open. I absolutely loved it. But she didn't run into Iga Świątek playing her best tennis. And Aryna Sabalenka let that one go in the final. And I think there will be matches and big moments where these players don't do that against her, and they do bring their best tennis against her. And I still think there are players with a sort of higher level at the moment than her. So I think long term, trying to fix the forehand probably does remain a big priority for her. But I so admire the way that she has found ways around it for the moment. It was an absolute triumph mentally, as much as anything, I would say.
Yeah, absolutely. And it kind of brings us on to the next category, which is surprise of the year, because it was a surprise to me last year that Coco Gauff won a Grand Slam. And that's kind of what I mean by the journey that we've been on with her, because 2019, we were all assuming Coco Gauff would have accumulated multiple Grand Slams by the age of 18. And then age 19, we're like, God, she's winning Grand Slams with that game. That's good going, isn't it? It's I don't know. Tennis is a weird old sport, isn't it? So let's talk about our surprises of 2023. We're going to hear from. Let's start with Mary, because I think her surprise might be the same as mine. Let's hear what Mary's got to say.
Alina Svitolina was the biggest surprise for me because I hadn't realized that she was making a comeback. She had married Gael Monfils, and the birth of their child was a big thing to them. But then the war came, and the war and devastation of the Ukrainians' country inspired Alina to give everything she had to her game. And she came back stronger and smarter and more aggressive than I'd ever seen her. More determined than ever. Because sometimes it looked like she'd kind of gotten upset with herself and pouted at the end of some matches. That didn't happen in Paris. She doesn't play big babe tennis, and I have never picked her to win a major, but I sure wouldn't mind one more surprise from her. I want Alina and her country to win big next year.
I remember being in Indian Wells with you two when the news came out that Alina Svitolina had been given a wild card into Charleston, which was the start of her comeback. And I remember being so taken aback by that. I remember thinking, God, it hadn't even occurred to me that Alina Svitolina would come back. And I feel so ashamed of that now because it's very unfeminist of me. But Yeah, I didn't think she'd come back. I didn't think she'd come back a better player. I didn't think she'd come back a different player. I did not think we'd be talking about Elena Svitolina at all in 2023. And then even after she came back in Charleston, I guess I thought, oh, maybe she's just sort of satisfying some curiosity. Some of the press conferences that I've been in of Elena Svitolina's this year and the steely look she's had in her eye, some of those moments are ones that'll really stick with me from this year. And I absolutely wasn't expecting to enjoy Elena Svitolina's tennis like I did this year. I wasn't sort of like, oh, I hope, you know, the way I am with Naomi Osaka and Bianca Andreescu, and like, oh, I hope they come back. I hope they can recapture some of that form because they were so great for the sport. I had no negative feelings about Elena Svitolina whatsoever. I was completely neutral on her, but I wasn't missing her in the sport at all. I wasn't missing her tennis. I wasn't thinking about her at all. And yet she's been a big part of 2023. For me, and I share Mary's view that I'm not going to be picking her for any slams still. I still think it's a bridge too far, but I would bloody love it if she could, by hook or by crook, even just make a final. That would be glorious. Not just because, you know, of what she seems to stand for now, but because of the brand of tennis that she plays now. She's a great watch, and I can't believe I'm saying herself. That about Elena Svitolina. It's unbelievable.
I wasn't expecting it either. And yeah, to my mind, she's already won big this year because of that, because she has reinvented herself after years and years of watching a player that you knew exactly what you were going to get year after year. That was not the case this time. She was taking it to people. She was taking it from people. And the match she had against Victoria Azarenka, I think, was one of the matches of the year. And real joy to watch her, and yet obviously tinged with terrible sadness, because you know how much she's hurting inside at the same time.
Yeah, I think surprise of the year is a great category for Svitolina, and I would give a shout out to that afternoon at Wimbledon as my moment of the year, when you two were both on centre court watching Iga Swiatek save match point and beat Belinda Bencic in an incredible match, and I was having FOMO, missing out on that, because I was on court one watching Azarenka Svitolina, and Azarenka won the first set really easily, and it was like, oh, why am I here? This rivalry always goes this way. Azarenka always beats Svitolina, and then suddenly Svitolina turned it around, and suddenly I was in the perfect place, and you had these two matches happening simultaneously. It was just, I think it was raining on the outside courts. They were like the only two matches on. It was just absolutely a phenomenal just afternoon of tennis. And yeah, Svitolina ended up winning that third set in a final set tiebreak. It was just magical. And yeah, sort of reinventing herself as a tennis player. And yeah, if you allow me a brief moment to say one of my other surprises of the year, which also weirdly involves Svitolina, I think one of my surprises of the year is Tsitsidosa, and I had just finished watching Svitolina Kasatkina on Suzanne Lenglen, and the entrance and exit to the press seats on Lenglen are such that you kind of go under the court a little bit, and I always feel like I'm in a place where I'm not really allowed to be, or I shouldn't be. And you do see, you know, players and entourages down there. And Paola Badosa walked past me after I left the court for Svitolina Kasatkina, and I remember thinking, "Huh, that's weird. She pulled out of the tournament before it had even started. What is she still doing here?" And of course, she was sitting in Tsitsipas's player box, kind of disguised at the time. And I never even considered it. I didn't even put two and two together at all, even though Tsitsipas was doing the head pointy thing at that stage, sort of kind of in tribute to Badosa. But yeah, that was a real shock for me, and a sort of a moment where I realised that I don't have a future as a gossip columnist, because I missed a pretty big sign there, and someone else got the scoop.
we could have broken the story rather than breaking it via Spotify.
Yeah.
bit like when Kim Sears walked past me in that sort of t-shirt warning everybody about her language and I sort of just said hello and I didn't notice the t-shirt despite the agent looking at me as if to say look, you know, kind of like what yeah, it's good, isn't it, final. Oh, well done me.
Definitive David Law anecdote that. Let's hear from Matt Futterman on his surprise of 2023.
Two words, Mira Andreeva, full stop. I don't recall anyone saying, watch this kid. She's going to come out of nowhere and not only win some matches, but also charm the hell out of tennis fans and tennis writers everywhere. And I think the among that, within that surprise, the biggest surprise was the first time I sat down with her in Paris. I was sitting around with, you know, a kid, 15, 16 years old, and I really didn't expect it to be much of an interview. And, you know, she was in her third language, English, because her first two are Russian and French. She was being sarcastic and joking and talking about school and making fun of her mother a little bit and talking about the stage and really just having no problem with anything and having the absolute time of her life. And I don't know what I expected going in, but it wasn't that. And I hope to see more of it. I didn't mind that she had her blow-ups and that she had her moments of being a teenager and acting like it on the courts, especially at the French Open and Wimbledon, because stuff happens when you're a teenager and all these people need some time to grow up and it's no fun to grow up in the spotlight like that. So I'm just hopeful we'll get to see more of what I think is one of the really bright personalities in this sport moving forward.
Hear, hear. Yeah. We don't talk enough about, probably because it's really boring for anybody listening, but tennis players' linguistic skills, I don't think, and their ability to make jokes in their non-native language. Fluency is one thing, but I don't know. Incredible stuff.
Really like what Matt said there. I really feel a sense of responsibility with Mira Andreeva as the media right now to not screw her over the way Andy Murray got screwed over, who was another person with sarcasm, who used his humour and jokes to which ended up hurting him, and because they got misreported. It'd be so easy to misreport Andreeva. When she's in these press conferences, she'll sometimes say things that are slightly outlandish, and she's got a twinkle in her eye. And we've got to make sure that gets across, and not just report things literally, because you don't want it to clam up. You don't want it to change. And also the stuff on court, yes, absolutely, it needs to be reported. Some of the things she did, one or two of them were really cutting it close and could have been dangerous, etc. But she has to be given a bit more leeway and at this age. And I love watching her. I think she's a brilliant watch. She's brilliant potential for the future and just fun. So let's have more of that.
Hear, hear, David, hear, hear. Last one in this category, and an important entrant, I think, definitely needs mentioning. Let's hear now from Chris Clary.
Well, I would say it has to come from the women's game. And though I'm very tempted to go with the crazy fact that there were three lucky losers who won WTA titles this year in a single season in the summer after having only three others do it in the entire history of the WTA Tour, that's pretty crazy. You had Maria Timofeva in Budapest, now Hibino in Prague, and Sara Sorribas-Tormo in Cleveland, you know, all do it as lucky losers and going to win the title. These are, you know, not 1,000 events, but still, that's crazy.
And yet, can't go with that. Got to go with Wimbledon. Got to go with Marketa Vondrousova, the first unseeded woman to win Wimbledon singles ever. And, you know, the lowest ranked champion since WTA rankings started at Wimbledon in singles. And frankly, you know, I think her record coming into Wimbledon on grass was something like 2-10. She had won only, I think, a round once, had done nothing really on grass to speak of, considered clay her best surface. Clearly, she was not an unknown. I mean, she had reached the French Open final before losing to Barty, also an Olympic silver medalist in singles. So clearly a fine player. But that moment surely didn't seem like her moment. And with people like Sabalenka with her grass court skills and Ons Jabeur and Elena Rybakina, people of that type of quality with grass court skills, it just, to pick Vondrousova would have taken something extraordinary in the prognostication department. So, yeah, for me, Marketa Vondrousova winning Wimbledon is the surprise of the year.
Do you remember all of the Frankie the Cat chat?
Yes. When we were desperately, the assembled media were desperately trying to get to know Marketa Vondrousova.
Yeah, it was desperate times, wasn't it? Which does her a disservice, because she's far more interesting than sort of desperately scrabbling around for questions about her cat. Mm. She's just not classically wear your personality in your sleeve type interesting. But she has been a fascinating addition to the top of the women's game in 2023, I think.
Totally. Yeah, she's just got such a unique game, such an interesting game, that has had good results on all surfaces now, as Chris has listed there. Obviously, it was a huge surprise. No one was expecting Marketa Vondrousova to win Wimbledon. And yet, I think I'm now in a place where I'm not surprised by anything that Marketa Vondrousova does. Like, you know, she is sort of capable of the very top of the sport and also disappearing for a few months. And that is
like
sort of,
in that match against Daria Kasatkina, Matt, at the French Open, when I'd said she'd get to the final. And right, she just totally blew it.
Which was, you know, 5 or 6 weeks before she would then go on to win Wimbledon. You know, that is who Marketa Vondrousova is. And personally, I've sort of felt a bit guilty about that match and that moment the entire year, really, because if I had to say the toughest pod to record all year, I'd probably go with that one. Having to record the show live moments after what we'd just seen from Ons Jabeur, I was guilty of viewing that match through an Ons Jabeur lens, and I did it the year before in the final as well, but it wasn't quite so devastating. But it was just a complete choke, and Jabeur couldn't play, and it was devastating. I had to go for a walk around the grounds at Wimbledon before we recorded. I was in a bit of a state, and sort of in all that, I think Marketa Vondrousova's achievement there was maybe a little bit lost, and her tennis was brilliant all tournament. She beat five seeds, a lot of players who you would have thought would be more naturally comfortable on the grass. And yeah, she was absolutely awesome. And it was a huge surprise. And I can't wait to be surprised by her again over the next few years, because I know that she will pop up and surprise us again. And it will feel like a surprise again, even though it probably shouldn't.
Yeah, what does Frankie the Cat have in store for us in 2024? Only time will tell, folks.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive and June. Olive and June gives you everything that you need for a salon quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive and June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive and June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Hello, Tennis Podcast listeners. David here. Now, you might know that I love a bit of cooking, and I think I'm quite good at it. But if I'm honest, even I get fed up trying to work out what to do every night. That's where Home Chef comes in. Being able to put together a delicious meal without the long prep and the cook times, well, that's pretty cool. Home Chef provides fresh ingredients and chef-designed recipes conveniently delivered to your doorstep to simplify your cooking experience. They have over 30 options a week and serve a variety of dietary needs, so you don't have to worry about what to make ahead of time. Not only is it convenient, but it's economical too. Home Chef customers save an average of $86 per month on groceries. Now, for a limited time, Home Chef is offering Tennis Podcast listeners 18 free meals plus free dessert for life and, of course, free shipping on your very first box. Go to homechef.com/tennis. That's homechef.com/tennis for 18 free meals and free dessert for life. You heard it right.
The next category is disappointment of the year. Let's start by hearing here from Matt Futterman.
I want to couch this by saying it's a disappointment sort of on behalf of the players. I'm not disappointed in these people. I mean, they're trying their best and doing everything they can. But there's these two Canadian players. One is Bianca Andreescu and the other is Denis Shapovalov. And there's probably no two players I love watching more than those two. And they just play with, you know, a silkiness on Shapovalov's case and a grit and an energy in Andreescu's case that I just find completely irresistible and circle their names whenever I see it on a draw sheet and wander over at some point or try to. And they both were just so broken this year physically and just weren't able to perform at their capabilities. And I think that's incredibly disappointing for the sport. And I know how disappointed they are. They both seem to really want to do well at this, and if their bodies will allow them to, be great for them and both great for tennis and great for Canada as well.
Well, as you can expect, I very much share Matt's disappointment, particularly about Bianca Andreescu this year. I haven't given up on her, but I do think I'm ready to admit that I have been in denial. And I'm no longer assuming that it'll happen, that it will come back. And I think maybe I'm not saying I haven't got my hopes up since this moment, but I think maybe the seminal moment for me in terms of, you know, realizing it's if not when with Andreescu was having watched her beat Victoria Azarenka in the first round of the French Open on Simone Mathieu, that incredible match. Just such high quality tennis. Can't believe that was on the third court at that event. And I remember recording the podcast after that match and saying, watching tonight, I realise I've been kidding myself about Bianca Andreescu, because tonight that was the real Bianca Andreescu showing up. And that's what we've been missing. And that's what hasn't been there since 2019. And then she went and lost in about 12 minutes to Lesia Sorenko in the next match, a match that we sent our mate Dave out to watch on his ill-fated trip to the French Open. And look, Lesia Sorenko is a good player and a canny player, I suppose she can give anyone a run for the money on the day, but the manner of that defeat was quite chastening for Bianca Andreescu fans. And I worry now. I'm now in a state of trying desperately hard not to get my hopes up, and you know, one day maybe she'll surprise me. But
look at me and Grigor Dimitrov, Catherine. You know?
Yeah.
It's never too late to try again.
Cue me doing Bianca Andreescu predictions at the Australian Open.
It does show you, though, how you can kind of forget about people. And it takes someone like Matt to remind you, really, that who they are, or that there were, you know, just I haven't thought about those players for such a long time. And I think that that is, particularly in the case of Andreescu, that is sad because of how brightly she shone 4 years ago. And these things can happen. And it's a shame, though.
I think I've fallen into the trap with Andreescu of getting very, very excited when she wins a first or second round match in like a really, really dramatic fashion, because that was how she sort of burst onto the scene, wasn't it? In 2019, she had so many dramatic matches that sort of defined her. And I sort of think of her in those terms. But of course, in 2019, she was able to sort of string them together. And it seems that now they're very much sort of one off. And I think, oh, she's played this dramatic match. That's Andreescu back. That's who she is as a tennis player. But actually, probably now what would be more revealing that she's back is if she was trying to win some of these matches comfortably and frequently getting to the latter stages of tournaments, rather than just showing us a glimpse of that incredible grit and energy, to use Matt's words, that she can display. She hasn't really been able to sort of deliver that at the back end of tournaments. It's always been at the start, and maybe that's been indicative of, yes, great grit and energy, but maybe not actually the best form. And you could throw, and I thought Matt was going to when he started listing Canadians. I thought he was going to mention Félix Auger-Aliassime. You know, it's been a tough year for him as well. Maybe he doesn't quite move Matt in the same way that sort of Shapovalov and Andreescu do with their tennis. But yeah, obviously some good signs from Fernandez at the end of the year, helping them win the Billie Jean King Cup. But that whole generation of Canadians that everyone was, I think, rightly so excited about, tough year for them, and that's a hope for next year, that they can all get back on track and show us what they can do again.
Tough year for me, Matt. I mean, I turned to you at one point during the Australian Open. I mean, an early point, presumably, I think sort of midway through her first round win, I said, God, is Bianca Andreescu going to win the Australian Open? and she lost to Christina Buchscher. Let's hear now on a rather somber note, actually, let's hear from Mary Carrillo on her disappointment of 2023.
The biggest disappointment for me was when Chris Evert told me that her cancer had returned to her. It was a gut punch. My great friend had already fought back so hard against this insidious disease. And except for some outstanding cursing from her, she has handled it with grace and humility and class. That Chris Evert continues to speak so publicly about her cancer and exhort the rest of us to know our family history and to take care of ourselves. All I want to do is take care of her.
Yeah, pretty moving stuff from Mary there. We had the news this week out in public that Chris Evert's ovarian cancer diagnosis had returned. She's currently receiving treatment for that. Goes without saying that we wish her so well. There's a very moving picture that emerged yesterday of Chris Evert and Martina Navratilova sort of rallying round one another, and I think Martina was cooking Chrissy dinner, and Martina saying, you know, we're in this together. Yeah, I've worked with Chrissy quite a lot in the past, and she's a hell of a woman. And good luck to you, Chrissy. We're thinking of you. It's a horrible blow, and as Mary says, a horrible disease. And I'm sure lots of people listening have loved ones that are experiencing something similar. And we're thinking of you. It's tough. Let's hear from Pam, shall we, on her disappointment of 2023.
The biggest disappointment in 2023, I would have to say, was how the WTA Tour Finals came down in Cancun. It just disappointing that it didn't reach the level of quality and well-planned promotion. Obviously, still unusual circumstances because of what's going on in China the last 4 years. You know, what may eventually happen in Saudi Arabia, but not quite ready in 2023. The uneasy situation for players from Russia or Belarus being able to go to, say, the Czech Republic. The other possibilities for the year-ending championships didn't add up to what Cancun could do financially. And then the fact their indoor stadium ended up not meeting the criteria, and them needing to build at the last minute an outdoor stadium during a time of the year where playing outdoors is a challenge. So overall, it was disappointing that once again, the year-ending championships of the WTA Tour did not pay tribute and highlight the WTA Tour as we would like to see. And obviously, there's enough blame to go around, but let's just find solutions for 2024, and let's just do better for the year-ending championships. Always, for decades, such an important event for the women players.
Yeah, I think we'd certainly echo that, wouldn't we? And maybe this brings us more on to fears, which is our next topic. But our collective fear, I think, is that unfortunately, doing better for the WTA finals in the eyes of the WTA and others might end up being hosting them in Saudi Arabia, which has been a massive topic of conversation and debate. And we've heard Billie Jean King's views, and we're wrestling with them all the time. I don't want to speak for you two, but overall, my needle is not moved on that. And it's a big, it's both a big fear for the future and a big disappointment for me from this year.
It's a grim period for the sport, I'm afraid, at the moment. And I mean, my biggest disappointment I've got noted down was the way that Steve Simon folded after the stand taken about China, and then just the sudden relinquishing of that stand, which ultimately led to what Pam's described as that sham of a WTA finals. And now here we are on the brink of another crap move of going to Saudi Arabia as the inverted commas solution. It's just depressing. And having seen what John Rahm has done in golf the last week, and him just folding on his previously held strong views because of the enticement of money, just do better than that. And pretty down about it.
Yeah, not much more to add, really. I think the fact that WTA's finals sort of would win my disappointment of the year is testament to how bad it was, because I really thought that the sort of sexism and the shadows period of the year had it sewn up, when we had the women not being able to speak after their doubles final in Madrid, and then we had the women's final in Rome being played in the middle of the night, and then we had one night session for women at the French Open yet again. I thought I was going to lump that whole period together as my disappointment of the year. And of course it's tied into what happened at the WTA finals at the end of the year. The sort of overarching narrative would be, you know, poor treatment of the women players. But yeah, I mean, and honestly, the fact that the ATP Next Gen finals were in Jeddah the other week, and it just happened, and no one said anything, and I'd count myself in that, like I didn't mention it on last week's podcast, and that's kind of the problem. Like we can talk all we like about engagement and change, and my goodness, I believe Billie Jean King when she says that would be the reason she would want to go there, to try and change those attitudes and laws. But I think there's a tried and tested machine now of Saudi Arabia having sporting events, and you go there and nothing happens and you move on and the conversation moves on. And that's my big fear about what would happen with the WTA finals as well. You know, I'm sure it would be a very well run event and it would eradicate a lot of the issues that they had in Cancun. And then we would probably just stop talking about all the other issues, and Saudi Arabia would get exactly what they want out of it, and tennis would as well, but nothing would actually change.
Yeah, you're right. You can already feel it becoming normalised, can't you? I feel it happening. I was listening to a debate a couple of nights ago on Five Live, which was in general about Saudi Arabian plans, encroachment on sports washing, if is what I would call it, but not everybody would call it that. And I just felt like, I don't know, I just felt like the tone of debate was different to what it would have been a year ago. The strength of the resistance felt less fibrous somehow. I don't know. Maybe that's projecting my fears onto this situation. But that was certainly my take at the time. Well, while we're on this downer, let's get to everybody else's fears for the future. And because there's a collective theme, a thread, an invisible string, if you will, running through them all, we're going to hear them back to back. It's Matt Futterman, Pam Shriver, and starting with Chris Clary.
You know, my fear for the future is probably one many people share, and that is just that the sport gets fractured, divided. There are certainly fault lines appearing, and you know, tennis has been through this before a couple of times. You want to go back to the 70s, you know, with World Team Tennis, WCT, the Grand Slams, tours. You want to go back to the 50s and 60s with professional tennis and amateur tennis. And go back further than that. I mean, there's plenty of stories of division in tennis. I think the tennis is much more exposed now to becoming increasingly irrelevant if they don't really get their act together. And yeah, you can disagree with Andre Agassi about many things at times, but I think he's got the right analysis of how important it is for tennis to package itself as a whole and markets itself as a whole and really emphasize the men and women together and give as many people as possible, you know, the full power of the package. And it looks to me like there's an excellent chance that we're going to see more division and that and fragmentation and you know, a live style situation with Saudi Arabia or some other entity coming in and poaching some top players and creating a rival tour is hardly far-fetched. And I think it's important to have unity, not just readability. So that's my fear. And history of the game certainly indicates that it's a possibility.
My fear for the future for tennis in 2024 is that we are not, as a sport, have a growth mindset. We are not open to change, open to developing ways to appeal to younger audiences and to continue to grow our sport in a way that it deserves. It's the most global, equal, generational sport, co-ed. It has everything. And I don't think that we market our distinctive qualities enough. And my fear is we're going to lose opportunities to spread the great word of tennis in corners of the world that maybe are attracted to other activities that are more organized and better marketed.
I have two big fears moving forward about in tennis. One is that the big egos in the suits that run the sport are not going to be able to come together and create some sort of better tennis world moving forward, because I think that would involve some of them losing their jobs. And the next time I see a sports executive negotiate himself out of a fancy leadership job, it's going to be the first. So I have a big fear that whatever you want to call it, the status quo inertia is going to prevail, and we're not going to see some new world of tennis. And instead, what we might see if that fails is a really big splintering of the sport, and people going off in their own directions and playing in little barnstorming leagues, and the Grand Slams being left to sort of figure out how they want to rank players and hold their events. And it could be, you know, it could be a couple years in the wilderness. My other fear is on a much smaller level, which is that a guy named Ethan Quinn, who was the NCAA champion this year, he turned pro when he won the NCAAs as a freshman at the University of Georgia. And he wasn't expecting to turn pro, but he did it because there's a lot of pressure to turn pro when you win the NCAA championship, because you get a bunch of wild cards and there's a few hundred thousand dollars sitting out there for you, and there's some notoriety, so there's some opportunities there. Now, he saved match points in order to win that match. And if he doesn't save those match points, he doesn't turn pro. And I just think it's a terrible, terrible idea to make a massive life decision on a on the outcome of a tennis point, essentially, which is what he sort of did. And he's been playing challengers and winning some matches and losing some matches and wallowing somewhere in the 300s, which is not really a very good life for a tennis player, and not really a very good life for a 19-year-old who presumably was having a pretty darn good time at the University of Georgia. And I just hope he doesn't really come to regret that decision, because there isn't really any going back. And I'm sure he'll be fine somehow in the long term, but the sports world does funny things to young people who aren't ready for it. And I just hope he really was ready for it, and it's not something that he looks back on with regret.
Well, that was so interesting. I mean, all three of those contributions, fantastic, just generally, and I think exactly right. But Matt's coming at it with a slightly different tangent to certainly to what I would have thought about. And yeah, there's a lot to look forward to in the sport, I hope. But there's a lot to fear. There is. And we listen to our colleagues no laying up on golf, and I'm just scared of what their future is. And yet, is their future so much different to tennis's in terms of possibilities? Probably not. And that's the splintering idea. I mean, it's so splintered as it is, certainly in terms of the governance of the sport. Just wouldn't it be great to get somebody who's rich enough in a job, a big job, to just think, I don't care whether I lose the job or not. This is actually what needs doing. So let's do it. Take my job and let's do the right thing.
He makes a very important point, though, doesn't he, Matt Futterman? Executives don't talk themselves out of jobs.
No.
Even if they think they have the best interests of the sport in mind, and in lots of ways they might do, those best interest, those their interest, their agenda is never going to include, I don't think my job should exist in the future. I think that would be in the best interest of the sport. Funnily enough, that never seems to be the case, and yet we know that this sport has too many executives, too many people in power with a little portion of land to defend. And defending that land is their ultimate agenda, and it doesn't feel like it's going to get resolved. It feels like, again, rinse and repeat. We can just chop this bit out of this podcast, run it in next year's review show, and away we go. But it that the point he makes about Ethan Quinn, very profound one, I think, actually, about the sport. There's something very profound about all of sport, but I think in particular tennis in there. And that particularly on the women's side, it just feels anecdotally to me like there's an increasing number of tales of the sport not being a healthy place for young people to develop, to try and make their way in the world. It's an interesting one. It's an interesting one. Matt and I are familiar with Ethan Quinn from our time in New York, David, before you arrived.
Yes, we were watching an awful lot of Tennis Channel, and they have 24 hours to fill, don't they? So there's an awful lot of niche tennis content on there, as you know. That does feel like the home for niche tennis content. And in the build up to the US Open, Ethan Quinn was one of the players featured during the many interviews that we watched. I'll be honest, I don't feel as much of an Ethan Quinn expert as I should, having watched that. I don't know how much of it I retained.
Well, he was largely talking about other people, wasn't he? He was sort of just there permanently dialed up on a Zoom call, chatting about the tennis that was on.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He seemed a nice chap.
He did. And I think that is an interesting point, isn't it? Because I so often think of, maybe match points that players saved en route to a title. And I so often think of that idea of tennis being down to one point, very much at the top end of the sport. And that, because obviously that's what we're focused on. And in a way, that's sort of where it matters least. You know, like there's not a huge sort of financial difference between quarterfinals and semifinals, for example, of a big event. But at the bottom end of the sport, when a match and a person's career and life can kind of be changed by the way a point might go. And I think the example of Ethan Quinn is a really good way of sort of making that point from Matt.
Yeah, it's such a good point. We've reached our guest cameo contributor slot. And it is, of course, many of you will have guessed, Dialer Dan Evans. You'll see the reason we've slotted him in here, because he ends on a note that I think has a lot of parallels with the point that Matt Futterman was making there about Ethan Quinn. But he also gives us a bit of an insight into his year as well. So here's Dan Evans.
Moment I will remember most from 2023 would probably be Washington, yeah, most likely Washington, just playing so bad and then had such a good week was sort of spelled out everything about, you know, tennis, things can change so quickly, and that probably made me remember the most about 2023. Biggest disappointment was probably missing the Davis Cup finals. I thought they still had a good chance, but yeah, obviously didn't get to plan. Biggest surprise of 2023. Not much really surprised me of 2023. It was a pretty standard year on tour. I guess maybe how Sinner finished the year was pretty impressive. Tennis wish for 2024. I don't make wishes. Sort of get what you work towards, and sometimes you don't get that. So I don't believe in wishing. Tennis fear for the future is that the tours get, you know, sort of dispersed, with you sort of hearing rumblings about, I think, well, I'm not sure what it's called, a super tour or you know, a league or something. Yeah, I would quite like it all to stay together. And if it sort of disperses, certain players playing different tours wouldn't be good, I don't think.
You would think a Villa fan would be sounding a little bit more upbeat at the moment, wouldn't you?
How do I get on with him, given, you know, he doesn't... I've got a wish list. He hasn't even got a wish.
Doesn't believe in wishes at all, David. How's that working for you?
My whole sort of reason to be is all about what might happen. What could happen? Come on. I mean, listen, it's just... When we received those notes from Dan, I mean, listen, I sent him the same list of questions as we sent everybody else. And immediately he, as a professional athlete, saw it through his own lens as it affected him. And actually, I found it very interesting. I think the point about Washington and the trough that he was in form-wise, what was a real contrast to the arguably the best week of his career. Immediately afterwards. But yeah, these athletes, they live in this very narrow world for a lot of the time, and Evans, whilst he may sort of not make a song and dance about it, probably thinks about the world outside of his own bubble more than most. I mean, he is genuinely interested in the sport, he's interested in the world, but he has to be ultra focused on his own career first and foremost. But yeah, as you say, ended on the note that I think is the conversation point that will be taking precedence when we arrive in Australia. That usually you get in to Australia after an off season and people come together and there's a theme. There's something everybody's talking about, and I think that's going to be the theme. What happens to the tour? Will there be a diff? Will it change? What will happen with Saudi Arabian money, because it's coming, and. It's just what form it takes.
Well, close your ears now, Dan, if you're listening, because this is the wishes portion of the show. Our final question to our contributors was, what is your tennis wish, either for the immediate future or for the future more generally? And we have got some stunning contributions here, starting with two similar... ish responses, or certainly responses that share some commonalities. So we'll hear from Hannah Wilkes and first from Chris Clary.
It seems very likely that this will be the last year for both Andy Murray and Rafael Nadal. I suppose there could be a surprise if one of the two of them has some remarkable season, and Nadal a better chance probably of that happening than Murray at this point, with, you know, just... the way things have gone historically in recent years, but quite likely it'll be the last season for both. And so I would wish that they both kind of get a chance to go out on the sort of note they hope for. I think both of them are pretty realistic at this point about the possibilities. Maybe I'm wrong. Sometimes champions can fool themselves, but I don't think in their heart of hearts they expect to come back and dominate the tour in 2024 by any means. But I hope they get some of that, of whatever it is that they're searching for inside themselves, out of this last season, and that they get, you know, strong, poignant exits from the sport that they've given so much to and have given fans and their sport as a whole so many great memories over the years. So best of luck to them both.
So my tennis wish for 2024, maybe it's just because coming into the Australian Open, there are going to be so many players kind of coming back from their various absences from the game. But my big wish for 2024 is just more fun second acts for players, you know. As much as 2023 was about young players coming through, I feel like so much of the summer was kind of defined by getting to know Alina Svitolina all over again, and in some ways for the first time, and Chris Eubanks having this kind of mid-career revolution, and even Sabalenka at the Australian Open, you know, like players showing that kind of change and evolution and new possibilities are always possible. You know, it's always on the cards to turn things around and become kind of a new player. And, you know, and people don't entirely transform, they're still themselves, but players and their careers kind of contain multitudes, and it just feels fun that we get to see these new facets of those multitudinous potentialities, you know. So I hope that this year is just full of players getting to show us that there are still kind of untapped possibilities in their careers and taking things in new directions. And I wish in particular that Naomi Osaka's comeback to the game is everything that she wants it to be, and nothing like we expect it to be, but something great, because it feels like there's just so much more to come from her, and I'm really excited to see what those some things are. You know, and also if Ash Barty could just unretire and come back, like she knows she wants to, that would also be really good.
Going big with the Barty wish. That is, if Dan Evans is at one end of the spectrum, not believing in wishes, Hannah throwing in Ash Barty coming out of retirement is very much at the other end of the spectrum, and I am here for it. My tennis wish for 2024 is that someone somewhere grants me the strength to cope with the retirements of Andy Murray and Rafael Nadal, which I agree will probably come both this year. I suspect, if I had to pin my colours to the mast now, I suspect they'll come potentially at the same time. I think they could both go after the Olympics. Pray for Catherine, really. Start worrying about me now, and just worry about it solidly until it happens, and then for a while afterwards, because I'm gonna find that tough.
That'll be an Olympics tough live show that that we enjoy.
Hello, welcome. It's not getting closer anymore.
That's it. Like, I've been so focused on the comeback element for Nadal that I haven't really processed that it's probably also the farewell element in there as well, you know. But I must say, I am very much looking forward to Nadal, Osaka, Kerber and Anisimova all coming back at the start of the year. Like, I've got my backhand back. Kerber has been one of my very favourite players to watch over the last 10 years. Osaka, we know her potential, and adding her greatness on a hard court at this stage anyway into the mix at the top end of the women's game would be fascinating. Like, you know, I just can't wait to see, hopefully, peak Osaka again up against peak Swiatek. Like, wow. Yes, please. And then Nadal.
Raducanu
as well. Like, I guess I'm a little bit anxious about that one just because of, you know, some things we've been hearing about training and whatever. But, you know, certainly that is a wish for 2024, Emma Raducanu. But I feel pretty confident about those four players that I listed at the start, coming out at the start of the year at least. And yeah, they're all potential game changers in terms of how exciting the sport can be.
The Avengers are back, guys. Mm. Do you remember the WTA Avengers?
one tournament.
One great tournament, and then half of them retired. There's still time, guys. It's never too late to try again. We're going to give the last word on this podcast to Mary Carrillo. And, well, you'll hear, but hold on to your hats for this one, folks. It's a good one.
I've got a lot of wishes for 2024, and I don't think you guys are going to be able to use this one, because I shall be channeling my inner Chris Evert here, and I don't want you to get in trouble with the censor police, because you know how those bastards are. Maybe if I I'll just whisper my wishes for next year. Here it comes. Get your fucking act together, Tennis. Fix the impossibly overwrought schedule, you chuckle fucks. Stop talking about unity and actually unify your asses. And try real hard not to hold events in authoritarian countries, the kind that torture and kill journalists, that imprison and kill homosexuals, that crash planes into buildings in New York. Be better than all of that, Tennis. I'm an old woman. I can't take much more of this. Do the right things for the right reasons. And Chrissy, get your ass better.
Yeah, no notes on that. Utter perfection. Mic drop. That was 2023. Done.
Yeah. I don't have anything else to add either. So, see you next year.
Yeah. Go on, Mary. Should I tell you about our mascot?
Yeah.
It's a good one, folks. It's never not a good one. I say that every week, don't I? But this is Diego. I do love it when a very little dog has a very big name. You know, Diego is just feels like a sort of superhero name. And I'm not saying Diego, the dog, isn't a superhero, but he's one in a very small package. He is a 7-year-old Havanese. He's owned by Will Elliott, and this mascotdom is a gift from Gretchen Elliott. Diego loves snuggling on the couch, playing chase and chewing on his ball. He loves when his family comes home from work and school and gets very excited when he meets new people. He's never really liked walks. When Will asked the vet about it, the vet said Diego was fine, just a bit lazy. He's loved just the way he is. The way he is honestly just ridiculously cute. Billie Jean is suddenly becoming very animated on my lap here because she can hear me heaping praise on another dog. Matt Futterman has a Havanese. That's a new addition to his life in 2023. And this is further evidence that they are gorgeous, excellent dogs. So thank you, Diego. Thank you, Gretchen. And thank you, Will. We have new presenter mascots. They are not to be unveiled yet. I think there is some picking that still needs to happen. But it's in the works. It is in the works. We will have new mascots coming to you soon. We will also have new top folks and executive producers to be announced very soon. But we do have shout outs.
We have Robert Briggs, and he says, no relation to Simon.
How about Robert McNichol? Is he a relation to him of the Wimbledon Library?
No. Yeah, that's how that works, David. People call both their children Robert. we have seen Simon Briggs's brother.
Yes.
We saw Simon accelerating away from Wimbledon in the back of a car driven by his brother. But this is not that brother.
There is another Simon Briggs, isn't there, who's a listener. Who gets in touch.
Yes. Yeah, this isn't that person either. This is a separate person called Robert Briggs.
Who we're very grateful to.
Thank you, Robert.
We've also got Chris Wilkes, who is in Tucson, Arizona.
Hi, Chris.
Like Chris Clary and Hannah Wilkes.
Hey!
Yes!
Very good.
Very good.
We had a mashup very in good. The show of those two people.
Yeah, excellent. Matt and I, was Arizona one of the places we drove through? No, not Arizona. Nevada.
Yeah.
Similar. Yeah.
A state.
One of the few states in America Matt and I haven't driven through this year.
I should warn you, we're doing 5 shout-outs today, so just bear with me. We've also got Bev Neal, who is in Bournemouth.
Right, Bev.
Hello, Bev.
And Bev says, I don't think I share a name with any tennis players, but Bournemouth, my birthplace, is also the birthplace of Open Tennis, of course, and Virginia Wade. Yes. Also, Jodie Burridge went to school here, the same school as my dear late mum went to, from whom I inherited my love for tennis.
Oh,
fantastic.
That's excellent backstory, Bev. You really bailed us out there, because I don't think we could have come up with a Bev.
No, but I did cover the tournament in Bournemouth in 1999. It was rained off on the final day, and we finished it on Monday just before the sun set, and we would have had to come back on Tuesday otherwise. There was no TV coverage because the TV cameras just picked up and left. But anyway, it was a very enjoyable tournament won by Felix Mantilla. Remember him?
Yes,
I do.
Well, I know the name. Was it grass?
No, it was green clay.
Felix Mantilla wasn't.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Felix Mantilla, I didn't have him down as a grass specialist.
No.
Green.
Thank you, Bev.
Thanks, Bev.
We've also got Amy Kaufman, who is from a place called Sleepy Hollow, 45 minutes north of New York City via train.
What a cool name.
Hang on, isn't that a horror movie?
Yes, but based on a book.
Yes.
All right, Amy.
Right. Didn't know it was an actual place. That is also a state that Matt and I have driven through this year.
En route to your latest concert.
Yep. Don't remember seeing Sleepy Hollow on any road signs, but might have been distracted by
Federer being annoying on Waze.
Federer being annoying on... God, thank goodness I got rid of that in 2023. That was one of my disappointments of the year, how annoying Roger Federer is on Waze. Amy, thank you very much. Amy...
Kaufman.
Amy... Yeah, but tennis Amy's.
Do you know what I have got for you is a Kaufman... who is a tennis umpire, who is called Rich Kaufman. And, he was one of the very top umpires in the sport many years ago. So there you go.
You've made all Amy's dreams come true with that blockbuster reference. Amy, you're welcome. Thanks very much for your support.
And finally, we have Eli and Lucy Cronenberg, and they are in New York. And
We know Eli and Lucy.
I've been thinking a lot about them recently because we've been writing our quiz for our top level friends, and Eli and Lucy are 2-time defending champions.
Mm.
Oh yeah!
You they think you know a lot about tennis, and then Eli comes along.
Yeah, really, Eli and Lucy should have a tennis podcast and we should be going to their quiz.
Absolutely. If they ran a quiz, nobody would get any answers right.
No, we would do poorly in their quiz. They're ridiculous. But also sensational. Eli, Lucy, brother-sister pairing, love that. Thank you very much. Tennis Eli's? Tennis Lucy's? Lucy Arl?
Mm-hmm. Lucy Shuker.
Well done. Yep.
Lucy Safarova, but a different spelling.
And Lucy with an IE. Maybe she also rebranded at the age of 12. Right. On that note, I think it's time to call it a year. That was 2023. Welcome to any new friends of the Tennis Podcast. Hello to all friends of the Tennis Podcast. We recorded our Tennis Relived show about 50 years of the WTA at the end of last week. That is there for you to listen to now. Our Maria Bueno Tennis Relived show will be there for you in a few days' time. We also have a Q&A coming your way just for friends. So lots of content coming for friends of the Tennis Podcast over the festive season. Just a quick shout out to, well, no, more than a quick shout out to all of our contributors to today's show. They they made the show, and they're so generous with their time, not just for this one, but throughout the year, and all so supportive of the Tennis Podcast. So Pam Shriver, Mary Carrillo, Hannah Wilkes, Matt Futterman, Dan Evans, thank you very much. And also thank you to Chris Clary. And seeing as stockings need to be filled, I will just remind you that he's got a new final edition of The Master, his Roger Federer book, out now. Now that Roger Federer's career is complete, he'll also have a Nadal book called The Warrior coming soon. And as I said, he's big in Substack now, is Chris Clary. And if you want to check out his Substack, it's called Tennis and Beyond. And that is coming back in 2024, as are we. We'll see you on the other side, folks. Thanks for listening.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Kayla Itzinas.
Kayla Itzinas. I'm Kayla Itzinas, and I have been training a global community of women since 2009. I've created a brand new podcast, Sweat Daily, to help you level up your life and reach your health and well-being goals. From fitness tips to food that fuels you, meditation to motivation, we've got you covered. Sweat Daily, the happiest, healthiest, and most confident version of you awaits. Available on Apple Podcasts and wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.